Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. I'm going to read from the first book of Samuel, chapter 10. I'm reading from the NIV. And I'm reading from verse 5. So Samuel's speaking, and he's speaking to Saul. And this morning, we're going to talk about how to be a failure. Some of you might feel you're already experts in that field. I very much believe that I am. But what we're talking about this morning is how to be a failure before God. And of course, as you've already gathered, it's not to encourage you to be failures, but rather to encourage you to be... Okay, not a failure. Well, we'll use the word success. Okay? So this morning, it is about how to avoid failure and how to be a success in God. Okay? So we're reading about Saul. And it may be by the end of this morning that a lot of what you thought about Saul before might have a slightly different perspective on it, and I hope that's the case. So it says this, after you go, and this is Samuel talking to Saul, after you go to Gibeah of God, where is a Philistine outpost, as you approach the town, you'll meet a procession of prophets coming down from the high place with lyres and tambourines and pipes and harps being played before them, and they will be prophesying. And the Spirit of the Lord will come powerfully upon you, and you will prophesy with them, and you will be changed into a different person. Once these signs are fulfilled, do whatever your hands find to do, for God is with you. That's good, isn't it? Hey? Go down to Gilgal, and I'll come down and sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what to do. And as Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. And I'm going to nudge slightly further down. And I'm going to verse 20. And it says, when Samuel had made all Israel come forward by tribes, the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. That's a lottery lot type of. And then he brought forward the tribe Benjamin clan by clan, and Matri's clan was taken, and finally Saul's son Kish was taken. But they looked for him, but he wasn't to be found. So they inquired fair of the Lord, has the man come here yet? And the Lord said, yeah, he's hidden himself among the supplies. That's the baggage. And they ran and brought him out, and he stood among the people. He was head and shoulders taller than any of the others. And Saul said to the people, do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There's nobody like him from among the people. And the people shouted, long live the king! Right? So there we have our introduction to Saul. So just to give you a little bit of background, I'm sure you all know this, but just in case some of you don't, it's good just to sort of be aware of where we are on the page. In Genesis, we have the story of Abraham, or Abram, as he was first known, and he's in Mesopotamia, he's in Ur of the Chaldees, and he's called, and he leaves, and he goes to Canaan, and his name is changed to Abraham, and he's chosen by God. And he promises to follow God. And his nephew Lot splits from him, and he has his own family, which we'll talk about later. Then Abraham has a son, Isaac. Isaac has sons, Jacob and Esau. Jacob's sons obviously become, as what we know, the children of Israel. Esau's descendants become the Arab people, one branch of which are the Amalekites. And then eventually famine comes to the land, and Jacob's sons, through Joseph, go to Egypt, and they are in Egypt to escape the famine, and they stay there for 400 years. Then the time comes for them to be set free because they've been made into slaves, and they are returning to Canaan, their original home. Are we all okay so far? Of Of course, the problem is they've been away a long time. And so now they're coming back into Canaan and they face three challenges. They face the people who were there before they went away. They face the new people who had arrived. And they face other branches of their earlier family who hate the children of Israel and will do anything to stop them. It sounds very contemporary, doesn't it? So if you look at the enemies to the east, there was Mesopotamia. To the north, there was Canaan. From the other side of the Jordan, there were the Moabites and the Ammonites. And of course, if you've ever been to Amman in Jordan, you'll know that that's where they get the names from. Just on the other side of the Jordan, there's the Amalekites, the grandson of Esau, who hate the Jews. And later in the book of Esther, of course, try and wipe them out through Haman. Haman was an Amalekite. And then you've got the Philistines. Now, the Philistines weren't Arabs. Now, I mention this a lot because today you'll find a lot of people talk about the Philistines as if it's the same as the Palestinians. No, completely different. The Philistines were actually from Crete. When the volcano went up and they set sail, became the people of the sea, they tried to conquer Egypt and were turned back, and then they landed on the coast of Israel. And that's been proven now in DNA, and all the culture tracks back to Crete. So the Philistines were Greek, really. Okay? But one thing about the Philistines is they had a huge advantage, which we'll come to in a moment. And what happens is that after they come into Canaan, they find that they are their leaders of Moses has gone, of course, didn't enter the promised land. But Joshua, their big leader, if you like, that operated in a military capacity, he's gone, Caleb's gone. And now what happens is you have different tribal leaders called judges. And as the children of Israel are spread over the whole of the land, quite often these judges would overlap with each other because some of them would arise to fight the people to the east. Some of them would rise up to fight the people to the north. Some of them would rise up to fight against the Philistines. But eventually time goes by. And you can guess what the people start wanting. We want a king. We want to be like the other nations. We don't just want tribal leaders. We want kings. Now, do you know what advantage the Philistines had over the children of Israel? Let me read to you. Whenever the Israelites wanted to get an iron point put on a cattle prod, they had to go to the Philistines. And even if they wanted to sharpen plow blades or picks or axes or sickles or pitchforks, they had to go to them. And the Philistines charged high prices. So whenever the Israelite soldiers had to go to the battle, none of them had a sword. Except Saul and his son, Jonathan. Do you get the immensity of this? The Philistines were Iron Age people. They knew how to make iron. This is the end of the Bronze Age. The Israelites had no blacksmiths. They couldn't make iron. Now, sometimes when we read about wars, we think that it's all war all the time. And that's not the way wars normally get carried out. It's skirmishes and battles. And then ordinary life falls in the middle of that. And so you can see here that, when there isn't battles, they take their cattle goads, if you like, their prods, the iron sticks with pointy ends, and they've got to take them to be sharpened by blacksmiths who are Philistines, who charge a fortune. And how's about this? The only people with swords were Saul and his son Jonathan. So when you read about the battles, and I challenge you, read the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel. Fascinating book. When you start reading about all the pitched battles and everything that takes place, understand that all those early ones, they're fighting with nothing. They're fighting with just farm implements, right? Wood against iron. Now, obviously, as they win, because you're smart people, I know what you do. Once you win a battle, what are you going to do? You're going to grab their swords, aren't you? Yeah? So the only way for you to get swords is winning battles. Yeah? So eventually you will see Israel becoming better armed and better equipped. But at this stage where Saul comes in, this is where it's like. That's tough, isn't it? The people want a king because they want to be able to defend themselves against, especially, the Philistines. So what did they have? What did they have before they had iron? Well, one of the things they were experts in was slingshot. Now, slingshot doesn't sound very good, does it? But if you go at the museum in Jerusalem, you'll see they're about twice the size of a golf ball, hard stone. And if I read from Judges 20, it says this: the slingers were so good, they could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Wow. Now, just in case there's any confusion, when I say a sling at a hare, not the bouncy things that you see in the fields. We've got a hare outside our house. We saw it last week. We were photographed. Isn't that good? Sorry, by the by. But the hares that they could hit was the hares on the head. They were expert slingshot throwers. And of course, that puts David and Goliath in a little bit more of a context, doesn't it? Especially if there wasn't many swords around. No wonder nobody wanted to fight Goliath, because Goliath was not just... He also, read the story, had an incredible amount of iron with him. An iron spear, an iron shield, and a sword. Right? So no wonder people didn't want to enter into single combat until David came along. But that's later. So Israel badly wants a king. Maybe before we meet Saul properly, we should have a little think about our own lives and the issues around failure. Because we have a strange world today. I'm not trying to speak as if I'm out of kilter with this world, but it's interesting the way that the mindsets have changed lately. Yes? I heard about a new game of Monopoly that's come out. And it sounds really good, but you don't win the conventional way. You have to act as a team, because it's not good that people suffer loss and a sense of failure. You know, because people might find that emotionally scarring if they were to lose a game of Monopoly. And so the latest Monopoly is collaborative. Nobody fails, and everybody can leave feeling warm. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there was an old ethos that said, we don't get paid for going to work. We get paid for the value we bring to the work we do. Now, that's a very different thing altogether. Because some people think that work just means an opportunity to do emails or go on their phone or Instagram while they're at work. Now, I know that wouldn't apply to anybody here. Yeah? Because you're all ethical and But it's interesting, isn't it? The way that moods change. Paul quoted on Thursday night, and it was quoted in here, but whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might. Do it with all your might. And friends, as Christians, we should be understanding that we at work should be different to other people. We should be strong in what we do. If we work for an employer, we should be seeking to bless that employer by doing our absolute best. Not skivers. Don't know why I'm talking about this, but never mind, I find myself doing it. The best way to avoid being a real failure, or rather the best way to be a real failure, lies in not trying to succeed. Some people can't be bothered, and they are the real failures, let me stress that. Those who never accept a challenge are the real failures. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might. Do what you can rather than sit on the sidelines. And that goes for you as a Christian in church. Whatever your hand turns to do, do it with all of your might. Let's not be slipshod. Our car park manager does it to the best of his might. Good on him. Valued. As we greatly valued Alan before. And all that he did with all of his might. And Paul. Health and safety is the biggest thankless task, as we were reminded on Thursday. But to do it with all of your might means the church is protected, but everybody so goes and rolls their eyes because it's health and safety. But do it with all your might. If you're going to be a greeter, be the best greeter, right, that we've had. Let your face beam when other people come in and be genuinely interested in other people. Don't be one of those greeters that go, hello, and you're not bothered. We need to be the best that we can be. I'm reminded, Paul, because we go back a long way, Paul and I. There was a guy we knew called Jim Rohn. And Jim Rohn was a multimillionaire, and he was an inspirational speaker. And he used to go around businesses. And he used to say things like, you know, find a millionaire and go and say, tell me, what's the secret of your success? That was good advice. But then he also said, when you find somebody who's utterly failed, don't be afraid and say, tell me where it all went wrong. Because sometimes you learn an awful lot more from what's gone wrong in somebody's life than you do in terms of success. I won't mention which church I was at. But I remember a young married couple coming to see me saying that they were having marital problems. And it was clear to me that the woman, if I said I had an intuition that she was about to wander, you will understand. And so they invited me around for tea. And it was really nice of them, and they were really wanting things to work. And then after tea, the husband, newly married, disappeared upstairs. I said, where's he gone? Oh, he does this every night. He has tea, we come in, have tea, and he goes up into his room, and he plays the computer for 6 hours. 6 hours a night. How to get big ears and a flat head?
What?
And he wondered why his marriage was failing, and he's wondered why his wife was desperate for love. Sometimes you can learn an awful lot about failure from people. There are some people in business, and I've been in business for a lot of years, but they're more interested in golf than graft. They want a retired lifestyle before they earn success. We can learn lessons. We can learn lessons because failing needn't be a problem. You see, Abraham failed. He had some doozies. You read Genesis. Jacob failed. David was a world-class failure on occasions. If you call murder and adultery failing, which I tend to. But you see, failing needn't be a problem. It's our response to failing that is the issue. There's a real difference between failing and being a failure. Everybody makes mistakes, but it's how we handle mistakes with honesty and humility that counts. Sometimes things happen outside our control and things just fail. Am I allowed to tell them about you when you failed continually? If you don't know, I'm his dad. So, you won't believe this. There was a time when he got up off the floor and fell down. And then he got up off the floor and he fell down. It was called learning to walk. Now, we never approach our children and say, you're a failure. You got up and you fell down. He would only be a failure if he didn't get back up. He would only be a failure if he didn't try and keep walking. And guess what? He's good at it now. We need to learn that failing can be learning. And in business in particular. In fact, I know many people in business who are great successes now, but failed over and over again at the beginning. Why am I talking about the world in general in business? Because it's the same with us as Christians. We fail. Paul says, I'd rather you were adults rather than babies. Spiritual babies. And sometimes we have to go through the pain of learning to walk, to become adults and to become leaders in the spiritual realm, in churches. And that will involve some failures at times. But I want you to understand this. If God calls, he also provides. You must have been capable of success if you're chosen by God. Can you remember the first thing that happened with Saul when he's called by Samuel? You're going to meet some prophets coming out down the hill. Join them and you're going to end up prophesying. The Spirit of the Lord's going to come upon you. And you're going to become a changed man. Friends, if God calls you, he provides for you. He never asks you to do something that you are incapable of doing. Let me go further, because this might surprise you. In 1 Samuel 13, it says this. Samuel said to Saul, you've done foolishly. And yeah, we'll come to that. You haven't kept the command of the Lord your God, which he commanded for you. Listen. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. Have you got that? That changes things, doesn't it? Riding in down into Jerusalem that week before his death, Jesus on the donkey. Hail, son of Saul. There wouldn't have been a David if Saul had been faithful. Because it says here, for then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. Can you see the depth of this failure? Can you see the depth of the failure of this man? Can you also see that the plan and purpose of God won't be thwarted by an individual person failing? Because God will raise up another with his heart. But at the moment Saul started, the Spirit of God came upon him. It changed him. He could have been the man. As it was, he's the biggest example of failure. Maybe bar one other person. Let's think about him. I'm thinking of somebody else with the calling of God on his life. I'm thinking about somebody who was so trusted that he's given the job as treasurer of the disciples, Judas Iscariot. Jesus might have known he would fail, as God knew that Saul would fail. But God didn't make them fail. They became failures, thieves, and betrayers. Do you understand? I wonder, God would have brought his plan and purpose out some other way, of course. But Judas is not exonerated because he fit into the story of how Jesus had to die. He was still somebody who made his own choices. And had he been faithful, who knows where he would have spread the gospel along with the other disciples afterwards. I hope you get a feeling this morning that what we're talking about is important. God's plan and purposes won't be thwarted, but your life can be different. Because you'll be one of two people. You'll either be a Saul type of failure or a David type of failure. And the Saul type of failure loses. And the David type of failure repents and has a heart after God and prospers. We need a king. In difficult times, people want new leaders. Yeah? The cry for leadership really comes out in challenging times. And these Philistines have better technology, they have chariots, and they have iron weapons over wood and bronze. In fairness to Saul, he walks onto a stage that is incredibly challenging. But people want instant solutions. And a new king would seem to be a good way forward. It's like people in the middle of a car crash suddenly want things to be different, as if they can choose somebody else to be behind the wheel and suddenly everything will be all right. But won't, because you're in the middle of a car crash. I suppose it's like politics, isn't it? People want answers in impossible times. COVID billions have been spent. Housing NHS pressures with huge population increases. War in the Ukraine. Defence demands billions spent in meeting debt repayments. Oil price hikes. Across the Western world, inflation's raging. Problems in the Red Sea. A wave of new AI is going to create incredible amounts of unemployment. But for people think for some reason a change in the government will give them an easy answer. Now, I'm not being political. I'm not saying this government's any good, isn't it? It's a shambles. But if you think that Labour's going to do any better, you know, don't kid yourself. Even in churches and their tiny institutions, many a pastor lands at a church, not being aware of its history, and find the church is in the middle of a car crash. And they bring in a new pastor, hoping that everything's going to change. And they can, but only if you have a heart after God. So, the first problem is, how do people choose leaders? Now, in fairness, Samuel was told by God to choose Saul. But it is a truism to say that leaders are chosen usually for their surface appearances rather than their inner qualities. Yeah? If you don't look like a leader, you're not going to be a leader. Domineering personalities get the jobs more than people of character. Saul is head and shoulders taller. Probably doesn't have dandruff. That was a joke. Head and shoulders. It was a head and shoulders joke. Sorry. He's the most handsome. It's rather the way that we choose pastors for this church. Got to be tall and handsome and good looking. Yahweh wants somebody to follow in the tradition of Moses and Joshua. But the people are looking for a leader, a war leader. And they get warned, if you go this route, it's going to mean taxation. It's going to mean conscription. It's going to mean palaces and forts. At the moment, they're all just tribes. None of that. No tax. Like the sound of it. No conscription. But the minute you put a king in charge, everything is going to change. Because those things come with kingship. Now, in fairness, they would ask a point for us a king. But that has been going on for a little while. But you see, they really wanted a sort of permanent judgeship. And they tried it before. Can you remember the story of Gideon? Gideon wins over the enemies, great. And then the people go to him and say, rule over us, you and your sons and your grandsons, for you saved us from the hands of the Midians. And Gideon says, I won't, my son won't, and we're not going to accept it. But they wanted Gideon to become a king. And then what happens when he dies? He has 70 sons because he has lots of wives. One of them, Abimelech, bumps off all the other brothers and sisters that he has. So he's the other one left to try and become king. So it hasn't just happened with Saul. And even Samuel, who at times does some very strange things, he's old. He appoints his own sons, it says, to be judges. And then it says they took bribes and perverted justice. And yet he'd appointed them. How should people choose leaders? Now, it might surprise you to understand this, that God wasn't against kings in general. In fact, in the book of Deuteronomy, the rules about having kings were set down. And that's long before this time. 300 years plus, ain't you? All this had been given. Do you want to know something brilliant about one of the rules for having a king? I love this. You mightn't, but I think it's brilliant. When you come to the land that your Lord has given you and possess it and dwell in it, I will set a king like the other nations around me. And then you will say, I will set a king over me like the other nations around. And you may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord will choose. So there's permission from God to the people that can set a king. But listen, the next bit says this. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of the law approved by the priests. The first job of the king, when a king was appointed, was to write out in his own hand the law that was given to Moses, the book of Leviticus. He had to write it out in his own hand. Why? He had to write it out in his own hand so that it was embedded in his head what the word was. You see, the provision was made for a king, but a king whose heart was centered in God. Brilliant idea. It also meant when the king was writing out, they would write down the exploits that happened in the book of Exodus. They would write out in their own hand how God had delivered them from Egypt. They would write out in their own hand about how the manna came from heaven. Do you get it? It would embed in them the idea that God is trustworthy. So let's look in detail for a few minutes before we draw to an end. I wanted to do this so that you yourself can be inclined to read the story in 1 Samuel. It starts off in a very familiar way. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish. Very plain opening, but it parallels the way that in particular the story of Samson is told. And in fact, you'll find parallels continually between Samson and Saul. The Lord intends both individuals to deliver Israel from the Philistines. The Lord's Spirit rushes on them both, empowering them for conflict. Once they fail, the Lord removes his presence following their disobedience. Both will die with the Philistines. And the parallels cast Saul as a second Samson, if you like, both physically impressive, both to have great promise, but both die tragic deaths. And then that compares with the way that David will be next. But we're not really talking about David. I just want you to get this for yourself. When we see failings and flaws in people, remember that if you put your heart before God right, blessings would follow. You don't have to be the brightest. You don't have to be the strongest. You don't have to be the wisest or the best at what we do. Just obedient to God. In fact, if we want to turn it round, if we're not obedient to God, then it doesn't matter how bright or strong or wise or how you're at the best at what you do. The key is being obedient to God. Saul, incidentally, means asked for. So when we find Saul mentioned in the New Testament, it might be that his parents couldn't have children at first, so they would call it Saul when the child arrived, the asked for child, if you're with me. So he might not have been named after the king, who knows. The story starts off before Samuel finds Saul. It starts off like this. Saul is out looking for his father's donkeys. Herd of donkeys gone missing. His job is to go out and try and find them. But guess what? He goes with a servant, can't find them, wandering around for days. He doesn't have any money on him. He has to sponge money off his servant who's got a shekel on him. They eventually bump into Samuel, and it's really that God's brought him to Samuel. Because as he comes close, Samuel is told by God, this is the guy that you're going to pick. He goes after he is anointed, if you like, and prophesies on the hillside. He goes home, but he doesn't tell anybody. He doesn't tell anybody that he's been anointed, if you're with me. Incidentally, the word Messiah means anointed. So it's special when you hear about somebody having an anointing. And then Samuel goes and he brings all the tribes, and they have to cast lots. And they say, okay, it's the tribe of Benjamin. Come forward, Benjamin. So the whole tribe of Benjamin comes forward and they say, cast lots again for the clans. Oh, it's the Matrites. Okay. Okay, from there, the house of Kish, from there, Saul. Saul, you're going to be king. He's not there. He's hiding, it says, in the baggage train. Got to think what's going on, haven't you? It's not an auspicious start. But one of the first things he does is brilliant. He's made king, long live the king. Then it says, Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged the area, and the men of Jabesh said, make a treaty with us. We don't want to be sieged. We make a treaty. And Nahash, the bad guy, said, on condition I'll make a treaty with you, I'll gouge out your right eyes. If every man in the city has his right eye gouged out, I'll let you all live. Sort of, can I phone a friend? I guess it meant that everybody lost their eye. They wouldn't be able to use their slingshots because you need 3D vision. So it would have been a way of making sure they could never rebel against him in the future. When Saul heard about it, he actually was furious and said, that can't be allowed to happen. And he got his plow and he split it and sent the pieces all over the countryside and said, I'll do this to anybody who doesn't turn up to fight. And he pulls across the whole country, everybody in, and they go and they deliver the people from these Ammonites. And there's some people who speak against him. Guess what? He's magnanimous. Those who had spoken out and said, we don't want Saul as the king. You know, the people said, shall we put to death those men who grumbled? And Saul said, no, not a man put to death, for today the Lord's worked salvation in Israel. That's good, isn't it? His first 7 days as king is brilliant. And then it goes downhill. He's got to go to Gilgal to wait for Samuel. Samuel doesn't come after 7 days, which it was promised that he'd turn up in 7 days. And Samuel decides that he will be the person who does the sacrifice. And he makes the sacrifice himself because he's run out of patience. In fairness, he's run out of men. Because all the men that had been with him, they're not a standing army, they're just people who turned up, all start drifting away home. And he looks and he's only got a handful of men left. I suspect at this point he is not yet written out by hand the earlier books of the law. He hasn't even written out the book of Judges or learned about the book of Judges. Why do I say that? Can you remember how Gideon went to battle? Gideon went to battle and raised an army, and God said, nah, you've got too many men. You remember that? Send some of them home. And then God says, nah, you've still got too many men. Send some of them home. And Gideon's like, really? Yeah, go on, send them home. So he's only got a handful of men left. But that is enough to win the battle. If Saul had had the heart of Gideon, he would have said, the men are disappearing. The men are leaving me. I've only got a handful of soldiers left. Brilliant! It means that God's going to have to do something great. But that's not the way that he thinks. He thinks he has to do it himself. And so he oversteps the boundary. And even there and then, he effectively loses the throne. And everything else in the life of Saul goes downhill. I was going to talk you through loads of it, but I don't think I should this morning. He seems to prefer sacrifice to obedience. He seems to prefer worship to obedience. He seems to believe in himself more than he trusts in God. He complains later to Samuel. And begs Samuel to forgive him. He begs Samuel to forgive him. He doesn't beg God to forgive him. And we could go through the downward progression of this man. Over the years, he trivializes his sin. He takes the credit for his son's victories. He breaks his promise over and over again. He marries off the promised bride to David, to somebody else. He becomes jealous. The Spirit of God leaves him. And instead, the jealousy acts like a cancer in his bones. Just for the record, David isn't born until 10 years after Saul's been on the throne. Saul's probably been on the throne 27 years by the time Goliath comes along. And it says Saul was an old man, and he lives the last 17 of his years just absolutely infected with jealousy for David. And do anything. And how does it finish? He can't hear from God. Samuel's gone. He tries to do things with the ark. He tries to do things with the Urim and the Thummim to try and find the will of God, and cannot find the will of God at all. And he's got a big battle coming up. And does the only thing that he can think of doing. He goes to a witch in Endor. A woman who possessed an ob. That's not a familiar spirit. It's sometimes translated. It's a ghost pit. We read about it in Greek myth, and of course the Philistines were Greek, and she lived on the edge of the Philistines at Endor. And they would dig a pit in the ground, and they'd put honey in and milk and wine, and they would summon up from the dead. And Saul sees Samuel for the last time. And shortly afterwards, he's lying dead on the battlefield, along with his son. A man of possibilities, a man with flaws and strengths, but spiritually superficial, rather than being a man after the heart of God. Whatever your hand turns to do, please do it with all of your might. Be people of integrity. When you get things wrong, put it right before God. Recognize that it's God that we've got to go to. And whereas it's good to apologize to people, that is good. It's no substitution for getting right with God. How to be a failure? Well, there isn't any better example probably in the Word than looking at the life story of Saul. He was supposed to kill off all the Amalekites and not even leave the animals alive. But the men all say, hey, we haven't had lamb for a while or steak. And so they don't carry it all through because their appetites were bigger than their desire to serve God. I don't know who I'm speaking to this morning, really, to be honest. I hope I'm speaking to something that makes sense in terms of life in general, but also your spiritual walk with God. Be people of integrity, and when you fail, just get up. Learn how to walk. But then when you learn how to walk, learn how to run. Be the best that you can be. And the Lord bless you.